Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Business Brew. I'm your host, Bill Brewster. Fresh off of Berkshire. Happy to meet a lot of you. Thank you for saying hi. It was super fun. Plug for Ensemble Capital as an employer. They are hiring an analyst. Should you be interested, please reach out to them. Best way I know is to email or check out their Twitter DMs at Intrinsic Inv. So that's at Intrinsic Inv. Throw Sean a DM or give him an email. If you feel like you're hyper qualified and he doesn't respond or something, you can throw me a DM, but I can't promise to forward it, but I'll do my best. This episode features Dave Waters of Alluvial Capital. Dave gets into some really funky securities stuff that you're not going to see in many people's portfolios. I enjoyed the conversation very much. He's the type of guy that, you know, when Buffett says if he was running small pools of capital, he'd look at off the run, obscure things. Dave does that. I think it's a good conversation. I hope you enjoy it. This episode is sponsored by DeLupa. DeLupa is founded by a former hedge fund analyst to bring simplicity into the investment process. DeLupa offers an AI. I mean, how dope is AI? AI is everywhere. But for real, DeLupa does offer an AI-driven single source for all company-reported data and allows for investment teams to make the most informed decisions in the shortest amount of time. DeLupa scales the velocity of an investment team's idea gen. Analysts spend less time locating and manually inputting meaningful disclosures into Excel and more time synthesizing in the minutes after the print. DeLupa captures data from all company-reported sources, including from footnotes, MD&As, and investor presentations. DeLupa's data sheets include GAAP to non-GAAP adjustments, guidance, and all company-specific KPIs. Each data point is auditable to the source for easy verification and accuracy. DeLupa's Excel plugin can also update your existing models for the latest quarter in just a single click. Bulge bracket banks and major multi-managers are trusting DeLupa for use in initiating coverage, building and maintaining industry dashboards, and keeping their models up to date. Visit DeLupa.com/businessbrew to create a free account and learn more about how DeLupa can help increase your team's speed to differentiated insight. If you are an institutional listener, somebody that works in an institution, I'd really appreciate you going to that website and at least checking out the product. It'll help me. I'm trying to help you. Let's help each other. That'd be awesome. How did I use DeLupa this week? I was peeping my favorite company, Qurate. Poor Qurate. For now. It's turning. I'm not currently involved. But anyway. And I was going through different customer accounts and had a question on what was going on. I clicked on the sell. DeLupa took me right to the 10Q. And I was able to take a look at what I wanted to see. And I just think it's a very seamless integration from the Excel file that you're looking at to the actual source data. I was able to contextualize what was going on, and I made some notes in my Excel file and moved on with my morning. So I do think it's a very good product. I think I like that it brings you the sources a lot. There's a lot of times that I see numbers on the file and then I click to go to the source and the source really contextualizes the number and sometimes completely reframes how I'm thinking of things. So I think it's awesome. One of my problems at the bank when I was working there was data accuracy. Sounds kind of silly, but putting numbers into spreadsheets was not the easiest thing for me. And DeLupa takes care of all that. It's all automatic. Should anybody ask me where I got my numbers, I can just click on a cell. Takes me right to the source. I can send that to them. I don't need to worry about transposition errors or anything like that. So I'm a fan. Check it out. As always, none of this is financial advice. All of the information contained in this program is for entertainment purposes only. Please consult your financial advisor before making investment decisions. Do your own due diligence. And P.S., I am long Garrett Motion. So when I speak positively about that company, know that I have a bias. All right, enjoy the show. Ladies and gentlemen, I am excited to be joined by Dave Waters of Alluvial Capital. Dave, how you doing?
Doing great. How about you?
I am very well. I'm excited to talk to you. Shout out to the man, Bill Wabufo, who put the seed in my head. And I was like, I should reach out to Dave. And thank you for saying yes. I appreciate it.
Happy to be here. And yeah, Bill is the best SpongeBob profile picture or Twitter character I know.
He's one of a kind. Man, so for people that don't know you and Alluvial, I will say, and then I'm going to let you take it away, but you've got one of the more interesting portfolios of anyone that I've ever seen. And when I hear Buffett say, if I was running smaller pools of capital, I would be going into off the run stuff, I just think, you know, of people that I'm aware of, you're the personification of that statement. So that's at least my perception of you. I'm open to it changing. And sorry if I pinned you wrong, but I'll let you speak for yourself. But I really respect how you go about your stuff, at least as I understand it.
Yeah, thanks. And I mean, you're right on. We work hard to find opportunities that are really far off the radar. And most investors, strange stuff that trades in strange places, unusual business models, little orphan securities that no one cares about anymore. And it's a ton of fun and it's worked well for us.
How did you get into this?
Long story. I'm sure we'll get a bit more into that as we go on. But I don't know, like, I've always had a strong interest in strange little unusual sorts of things. I mean, I was the kind of guy who would spend hours in thrift stores looking for old rare records and interesting t-shirts and stuff like that. And I know I kind of grew up in the middle of nowhere, had to make my own fun. So I'd go out in the woods and find arrowheads and stuff like that. And I don't know, I'm like just that. A really, really curious person. So I've always enjoyed chasing, going on wild goose chases and finding things that are just outside the corridor that most people stay in.
So, like, take me back to you're getting started. You must be writing about ideas. I mean, what is there, like five of you that follow any of these ideas, right? Like, there's like, it's so interesting to me because how do you find it and how do you get started? I don't know. Bill put me on a liquidation that you're involved in. Yeah. And, you know, it's like, I think it went dark last Thursday, right? It stopped trading.
Correct.
So it's April 12th to date the conversation. But that's probably one of the more, I guess Garrett's probably the most well-known thing. But mm-hmm. It's just been interesting to watch your letters over time and think about how you source these ideas and what it was like when you were starting, because so many of us, I think, start on the bigger side of ideas because at least you can get feedback, right? Like you're a man on an island a lot, I think. In a positive way, by the way.
That's true. It's positive and negative. I mean, there's a lot I like about it. There's some things about it that are pretty challenging, but I guess at this point I've been doing this full time for 9 years. And even a few years before that, I was spending basically all my free time on research and trying to dig up these ideas. So by now, I know a few of the shortcuts. I know how to cover a lot of ground and be efficient with my time. But there's really, at the heart of it, no substitute for just plain old turning over rocks. It's a popular phrase in the investment world, but it goes triple if you're looking at small, off-the-run, less liquid opportunities because, frankly, the majority of them are not promising. And you have to be willing to look at something and spend 10 minutes on it and say, no, not for me, on to the next thing. And I mean, we live in a world where there's probably over 50,000 or so public equities alone. And that's excluding the entire world of fixed income and other things like that. But probably of those 50,000 names, fewer than 2,000 get 99% of the attention. And so there's a lot of opportunity there in stuff that is not getting the attention. And for better or for worse, you can find something great and they can sit there forever because no one else cares. And that's the downside. But yeah, I get a lot of joy and it really scratches a certain itch I have to find something that I think I'm the first one to really put serious time into. And if I'm right, more people pick it up along the way, but it's fun.
Yeah, that kind of reminds me a little bit about Ian Castle's idea of being the first to discover something that I maybe should not have said Garrett. P10 maybe is better known. Do you want to talk about what it is? You don't need to, but I think you give an interesting overview of it. And two, when you found it, it was over the counter, right? Or even less over the counter than over the counter. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's absolutely fair. And yeah, this is a big investment of mine. We've done well, and it's now, you know, New York Stock Exchange listed, regular old small cap. It still trades kind of by appointment some days, but yeah, now it's a full-on SEC reporting listed company, but not the case when we found it. When we first happened across P10, it was a post-bankruptcy, semi-reporting, limited information shell company trading over the counter. And it was recapitalized by a couple guys I'd never heard of, but I immediately thought they're doing something really interesting. They're going to go ahead and plug an alternative asset manager, a really good one, into this little OTC shell. Something is going on here. So that gave me the impetus to look into it a lot more, and I love what I saw.
So how did you know it was a really good asset manager that they were plugging in? Did you like call around and just do some scuttlebutt on that?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I viewed all the filings I could find. Turns out there is, I'm going to mess it up exactly, but I think it's actually the state of Florida is a big investor in some of their funds, and they have their public performance data out there. Yeah. I talked to a couple people I know in private equity and family offices such as that. You know, hey, have you heard of these guys? Are they legit? And the answer came back every time. Like, oh yeah, they really know what they're doing. They have great information, great track record, and they're really a gem. So I was satisfied with that.
So you're going through filings. I assume you see this corporate action that you're like, oh, I like this. How, this is probably more of my personality talking than anything, but how do you remain calm when you find something like that and it trades like by appointment only sometimes, and you know that you're interested, but you also know the price matters and you can't just go out and buy something like that. Like that takes a real discipline to not, I think, let the emotions take over a little bit.
A couple of things. I think in some regard, that's just your personality. I mean, how everyone has a different threshold for what kind of immediate little dopamine hit they need from an investment. And some people have a longer time horizon than others. In some sense, it's innate, but in some sense, it can also be developed just by having enough repetitions and seeing enough cases and circumstances where you make an investment, everything looks great, the numbers are going where they need to go, the people in charge are smart, but the stock just goes sideways forever. But then sometimes in the course of 3, 6, 1 months, it doubles or triples. By seeing that happen enough times, it gives you the confidence to be able to stay invested in a holding that where the business is performing, but the stock price or the trading price, whatever, is just doing nothing or even trending down. And that's a bit harder. Because it makes you really second guess yourself, wondering if you missed something, but usually it's just pure neglect. So it's a mix of nature and nurture, I guess, just coming around and being okay with that.
I more even meant you're excited about finding the idea and you like the current price that's theoretically on offer, but it's hard to get the shares at that price. But what I'm hearing you say is the longer you do it, maybe the more you realize, hey, this opportunity isn't necessarily just here today, right? Like it'll probably be here for a while. I just need to pump my brakes.
That's true. And at the same time, I mean, there is the question, like, I want these shares. I need to get them somehow. And for me, it's come back to, if I really believe in something I see, if it's trading in a dollar, I think it's worth $3 or $5. Does it really matter at the end of the day if I pay a dollar or if I pay $1.10 or $1.20? If I'm right, I'm still going to make a great return. So yeah, I mean, sometimes you have to be a little bit aggressive, put an aggressive bid out there and see if somebody is waiting out there for that and hits that. You just, it doesn't pay to nickel and dime sometimes with these high potential but less liquid opportunities.
And then the follow-up comes is once you're married to these ideas, they are illiquid, right? And so there's always a premium on being right. I don't want to say this the wrong way, but you can get yourself trapped in something if you're wrong, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you learn to develop the muscle of what you're looking for in these ideas that you really have to be like, okay, owning, right? Like how much does capital allocation matter to you that maybe matters more in a micro cap than does in say like, I don't know, Charter, where if you don't like what they're doing, you can just like dump the shares.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. That's a luxury I rarely have in the stuff I'm looking at. Well, number one, your threshold for buying has to be a lot higher because, like, as you said, I can't change my mind and turn on a dime and dump everything today. So I really have to be sure that I'm willing to own something for at least 6 months, probably more like a year or longer, before I make a big commitment to that. And you can ameliorate that risk in a couple of ways. And the first, of course, is you can just keep your position sizes really small and run a more diversified portfolio. And I think people probably should do that. I think that unfortunately, the last decade really rewarded like highly concentrated portfolios if you pick stuff that was in vogue and moving up. And I think that a highly concentrated approach may be a bit more challenged in the years to come. And so I'm happy if I like something, but it's very liquid, or I think it has some kind of risk attached to it to make it a 50 basis point position or a 25 basis point position and not put 5, 10, 15% of my portfolio in that. There's nothing wrong with that. I'll find enough stuff to take up the rest of that empty space. So that's the big thing. And the second thing is just telling yourself from the beginning that I'm going to give this 2 years, for instance, and I try to look out, 2, 3, 5 years and sort of see what the company can be then compared to what it is now and say, okay, I'm committed to this for a certain amount of time, but if they don't execute in that amount of time, I'll sell. And then another thing is just to be ruthless with your portfolio. There's no room in the portfolio for things that are not forming operationally or are underperforming my thesis that I created when I bought into something. I think it's easy to get sentimentally attached because maybe you like the people. Maybe management are generally nice people. You enjoy interacting with them and they have good intentions, but they're just not up to it. I think it's better to take your medicine, even if it requires you to sell into a thin market and maybe push the price against you a little bit. It's better to get out today, down 5-10% from the current price, to be sitting here a year from now, still there or lower, because opportunity cost is a real important thing.
How did you, I mean, I guess, how did you learn the lesson is the question that I wanted to ask. And maybe that's the question, but have you hung on to anything too long that like you learned that lesson from? Or I think that's, I think what you said is objectively factual. I also think it's emotionally difficult.
I mean, I've learned that lesson the hard way on several occasions. I hope I do it less than I used to. I mean, I've been in this professionally for almost a decade now, and I've had plenty of chances to learn tough lessons and incorporate those into my processes and try to improve. But oh yeah, I mean, there's definitely been cases where I've given way too much of my intellectual bandwidth to a certain position that was just never going to work out. And it's so easy to justify to yourself and rationalize because if you really believe in something, that's just our natural human inclination to tune out any contradictory data, tune out any narratives that go against what we believe, but you have to stay open-minded. I recommend anyone who's managing money to go out there and seek out narratives that run contrary to what you use when you built a thesis around an idea. It keeps you humble and also remind yourself that you could be the brightest investor in the world. You can be the big guy himself, Warren Buffett, and still mess up. And don't beat yourself up too bad if you messed up on something because it happens to all of us. The important thing is limiting your losses and not going too big on your ideas. Just for staying to stay in the game is the important thing.
You know, that's an interesting going back to what you said earlier about concentration really worked, especially if you were in the right things, obviously. But surviving and concentration are often sort of when I think about how the world works, they are juxtapositions. And it's, I don't know, it's an interesting thought, right? Because the big guy himself says you should 50% of your money should be in your best idea, right? But I don't know that that applies to many people, right? He's a savant.
Well, it's also different when you have permanent capital. I mean, if you're running any kind of investment vehicle where partners are there at their pleasure and on some terms they can leave in the short to intermediate term, you have to not blow up. I mean, you have to perform. You can't be down 80% and think that these people, because you're a nice person or your friends, that they'll stick around because you messed up on your responsibilities as a fiduciary to your partners. And so, yeah, I mean, that's the number one rule of fund management is don't blow up. So yeah, that means diversifying your exposures, so you're industry-wise or what have you. It means keeping a watch on the leverage that your companies are taking on and the operational risks that they're doing. And it means that even when you have a position you absolutely love, that you don't let it grow to be, you know, 50% of your portfolio or something. Because I always say, like, what if an asteroid hits the company headquarters tomorrow and obliterates it? Crazy things happen in the world we live in that are unpredictable and no fault of our own. The world is a crazy place. And so you got to be able to come back from those negative left tail risks that show up now and then.
Do you think that those are more prevalent in the smaller and micro cap companies? My hypothesis would be that they are, but.
Absolutely. I mean, that's kind of my starting assumption with every one of these little companies that I look at is they have fewer financial resources, worse banking relationships, very little ability to raise equity on reasonable terms from the get-go. Typically have management that is, well, I mean, it's not many high quality CEOs' ambition to run a $50 million company at the end of the day. So yeah. Typically the management teams are, a lot of them are really great, really smart, but they tend to not be the most sophisticated cohort out there. So you have to take that into account. A lot of them have real deficiencies in a certain area. They might be great operators and really don't know about capital allocation. It might be the opposite. Maybe sales is a real weakness, or maybe they just don't know how to talk to investors. That's very, very common. They have a difficult time telling their story. But yeah, I mean, my baseline assumption is that any little company I'm looking at is a worse version of something much bigger, and I have to be compensated appropriately on price to make up for that.
Well, that was going to be my follow-up. So why play around in that bucket, right? But the answer is theoretically.
Because the price can be so good sometimes.
Yeah.
But yeah. The difference has to be really big. I mean, if there's a mega cap that trades at 15x, it's a pretty decent business. And I find a micro that's in the same business, you know, roughly the same margins like that. 12x, 10x is not good enough. Maybe 6 or 7x is. I mean, that's a judgment call for every investor to make. But yeah, I mean, you don't make money buying a smaller, worse version of a big company at a slight discount. It's got to be huge.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you mind talking about how you found Garrett? It's one that I know a little bit about, and I think it's very interesting. So I'd love to hear. I probably know a little bit about it because of what you've written. So I'd be curious on your journey on it.
Yeah. So Garrett, it was a fun situation, still involved. I really, really like bankruptcy plays and post-reorg situations. A lot of the time, because the bankruptcy tends to happen at the bottom of the business cycle for a lot of these businesses, especially cyclical, capital-intensive businesses like an auto supplier, like Garrett is. And so typically, a rebound happens. Sometimes that equity or whatever is very, very discounted coming out of bankruptcy. And sometimes you end up doing really well. And they're often kind of very unpopular businesses. I mean, you look at the great businesses of the world and nobody's going to put an auto supplier up there unless it's like super premium or something. And they're a good business, but I wouldn't call them that. And so they were a spinoff from Honeywell. And Honeywell chose to saddle them with with hundreds of millions of asbestos liabilities. And it turned out to be too much and they entered bankruptcy. And that's kind of when I started looking at it. And for anyone who doesn't know, the business model produces a lot of cash, but it tends to be sort of counter-cyclical. But things started to look better for them during the bankruptcy. And it soon became apparent that not only was the equity not canceled in the bankruptcy, but that existing holders would maintain their ownership, which is kind of a rarity in bankruptcy. But the real juice in the situation was that coming out the other side of the bankruptcy, shareholders would have a chance to invest in a rights offering. And what you would get in this rights offering was these very, very attractive convertible preferred shares that were convertible into stock one for one, but also had an 11% dividend attached to that. And I thought, okay, that's really, really interesting. And furthermore, the offering was going to be backstopped by a couple of large hedge funds, and pretty common in a bankruptcy situation. But they made it pretty clear that these hedge funds really, really wanted these securities. And I thought, okay, well, if they want that a lot, I want that too. And the paperwork for subscribing for these securities was just punishing is the word. I talked to multiple people who submitted the paperwork and had it rejected a couple of different times for kind of petty reasons, it seemed to me. And that made me think that, okay, these hedge funds, these large debt holders and what have you, they don't want to share this with anyone else. But I made sure that I crossed my T's and dotted every I, and I got the shares that I wanted and subscribed for all the regular ones as well as the ones that only institutional buyers were allowed to get. And because I knew that I thought the projections in the bankruptcy plan were pretty conservative. I thought there was a good chance that the equity would trade up over the next 6 to 12 months following the emergence, and it did. But I also thought that if the equity itself is attractive, it's going to trade up. How much more attractive will preferred shares that carry an 11% dividend and are convertible one for one? Those will trade at a big premium. And so the subscription price was $5.25 a share. And I thought these are going to come out and trade at least seven or so. It looked like free money to me. So actually on the very last day of the rights period where you could buy the shares and they came attached with the rights, I put about 10% of the portfolio into that. Just kind of a one day trade at the very last minute to get as many rights as I could. It just screamed typical special situation where it's not a very popular company, but the balance sheet looks much better on the other side. And there's this great security that these hedge funds want and they don't want to share it. But I'm going to make sure I do my paperwork and get in there in time and get every share I'm allowed to get.
So for those that don't know, they make turbochargers.
That's correct.
That would be the primary cash generator. And they're sort of diversifying into some electric stuff, but I think of it as a turbocharger company. So how did you find the idea? Like, are you combing court filings? Do you have like an alert that pops up or something? Like if somebody said to themselves, boy, I'd really love to go through bankruptcy filings, where should they start?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, the Wall Street Journal is as good a place as any. I mean, most bankruptcies get a good bit of press when they first file. National CineMedia or whatever is in the headlines today because they're filing. So yeah, it's a good way to gather a bunch of initial ideas. But I do find that after the initial flurry of headlines that things quiet down and there can be not a lot of information for a while. And so you have to start paying attention to the court docket, which always shows up under a particular law firm or something. And believe me, the court dockets and the filings and the statements there, they can be a real slog to go through, especially if you're not an attorney, which I'm not. But I have enough familiarity with the process at this point that I can kind of tell which ones are at least important and I should look at and which ones are, some attorney petitioning for, you know, their monthly fee or whatnot. Ignore those. So yeah, you need to get up on the court docket and start paying attention and look at the plans that the filer is proposing and the pushback from the various creditors and things of that nature. You look at it that way. I also have to say that for this one in particular, that investing social media was pretty helpful. I mean, I read a lot of Andrew Walker's stuff from the Garrett bankruptcy, and it really kind of got me up to speed faster than I could have got there on my own. And I'm always a fan of creating your little network of sharing ideas. I mean, I'm pretty active on Twitter, and I write online, and yeah, and that's great. But the real benefit of that is the relationships I've established with experts in domains that I'm not necessarily the preeminent voice in. And by having relationships with people who understood auto and understood the bankruptcy process, it really helped me get a lot of confidence and run a lot of things past. And I repay the favor when I can, but yeah, it's not easy to be a solo practitioner in investing. It helps to have a group of smart people that you've established that you can trade ideas with.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought the plan was pretty interesting. And the other thing that I thought was interesting about reading those filings was it really laid out, like, my dad's into cars, and he and I talked about, like, are turbochargers hard to make, right? Like, how easy would this company be to displace? It seems to me it's not so easy. And I think that the plan did a good job laying out sort of the value add and how it requires technical expertise. It's not something that is easy to spin up, nor is it something that if you're an auto OEM, I think you're really worth risking yourself betting on a new player when it's a pretty consolidated industry. Is it a duopoly? I think it's a duopoly, right?
It really is. It's a duopoly. Yeah. In fact, they tried to make a third competitor, a Chinese company did a couple of years back, and they had to give up after a few years, hundreds of millions invested. They just couldn't crack the market. So yeah, this is a case of a fundamentally okay business, okay to good, with an unsustainable balance sheet. And that's kind of my favorite of the bankruptcy opportunities. So the business is fundamentally okay. They just can't operate under the capital structure that they had.
Interestingly, if you were to just pull it up today on a financial screener, it still kind of looks a little bit unsustainable potentially. I don't think that the screen would tell you reality, but optically the debt load looks a little bit higher than I think reality may prove.
Well, that's another thing that I loved about the situation is I knew that this would screen very poorly coming out of bankruptcy. Because you had a situation where there are common shares that trade, but there's actually a lot more of these convertible preferreds. They represent the majority of the equity, and depending on your data source, how it classifies it, that might all show up as debt. You might look at this as a highly, highly leveraged situation, not realizing that all of those convertible preferreds are going to turn into equity in just a couple of years. And they've actually done an amazing job deleveraging. They paid off their pref Bs coming out. They paid off some term loans, and I mean, they were borrowing at 1% for 6 years or something. They really took advantage of that long, low rate regime that we had and termed out their debt. So yeah, they're on the verge of producing a ton of cash flow, but they still don't look good unless you know what the capital structure actually is and don't just look at the figure on the page.
So for a business like this, you know, we're coming out of the never sell environment. Is it most likely that someday it gets cleaned up and we'll see where it trades at the time, but let's say it trades closer to your estimate of fair value. Is this one that you look to hang on to, or do you ride it through that cycle and then you say, you know what, that has been a great ride, let's go find another?
Yeah, good question. You're really coming down to the concept of terminal value. Is this business year after year increasing the present, you know, the net present value of its cash flows from here to eternity? And that's a tough question with Gary, because as you touched on, turbochargers are pretty good product, but they are slowly going to become less relevant in a world of electrification and electrical vehicles. And so with that in mind, I mean, Garrett has been working hard on developing products for those lines of autos, but their meat and potatoes is turbochargers, which will probably go away by sometime in the middle of the next decade. And so in this question becomes in this case, it's a question of what will they do with their cash flows? Because following, like I said, the pay down of the Series B preferreds, following the conversion of the convertible preferreds, they'll have a lot of cash. I mean, they'll be spitting out probably $400 million a year. What will they do with it? I will not be super happy if they spend all of that money attempting to create wholesale new lines of products for EVs. I'd much rather them return that capital directly to shareholders, whether it's through special dividends or whether it's through buybacks, if they think that the share price is still not reflecting the net present value or the cash flow they can produce in some way. But I want them to return the cash flow. Sure, don't skimp on R&D. Keep working on these new products. They seem like they're going pretty well. But don't bet the firm on transitioning to a new second life as an electrical vehicle supplier. Give us our money. I don't have much doubt that that's what they'll do. The firm is still controlled by the former debt holders, and they tend to be people who want their cash now, as do I. So, but yeah, it's not something I think I'll still be holding, you know, a decade from now, unless they invent some miracle product. But I firmly expect that through a combination of capital returns and an eventual sale, I still think the IRR from here looks very attractive.
The debt holders are people can look up for themselves who's on the board, but it's a pretty impressive board. That was one of the things that got me to think, oh, these are guys that I would actually trust to give me back money as opposed to, like you said, bet the firm, right? And I appreciate that a lot. I've seen enough bad capital allocation and, you know, guys that are trying to protect their job that I like the idea of people in the room that care about me.
Oh, yeah. And to your point, that's a question I always ask myself when I'm looking at the management of a company, when I'm looking at the board. For instance, let's say a small community bank. When I look at the management team and the board, I think, do these people enjoy making money or do they enjoy being bankers? Because there's a lot of prestige still in smaller communities like the ones I grew up in being the town banker. I mean, you get your handshaken on the street. You know, you're at the country club. You're the head of the Rotary. And there's a lot of prestige that goes with that. And some of these people are just so happy to sit there and be a banker that shareholder value and actually optimizing the company is kind of an afterthought. So in cases like Garrett, looking at these people, they're not auto people. They don't have motor oil in their veins. They're money people. They want to make money. And that's the kind of people that I want to put my capital with.
Yeah. Yeah. That's something that through these conversations and whatever learning journey I'm on, I've begun to really Non-Gap was the first guy, Mike, that got me thinking about this. And I don't know, when Wyden and I talk incentives a lot. And it's just kind of interesting how it's so basic, right? But I think sometimes Munger's show me the incentives, I'll show you the outcome. I think sometimes that gets lost in the feeling of wanting to like an idea, right? Because yeah, it's like, oh, it'd all be so great if the incentives were different. It's like, well, they're not.
Exactly. And especially if you're someone making non-control investments in companies and you don't have the ability to set the incentives and control the behavior. I mean, it's different if you're private equity and you're coming in and you can set up your own incentive scheme and get whatever people you want in charge. But I'm not doing that. And neither are probably most of the people listening. And yeah, you're kind of stuck with whatever the incentive structure is. And of course, you get a vote, but it's tough to change things at small companies, especially because the little companies tend to be so personality driven. And that's a thing I think about a lot as well, is the entire executive team at a little manufacturer or something might be 3 or 4 people. And especially if the CEO has a strong personality, then it's pretty much his or her say at the end of the day. Compared to someone like, Danaher or Honeywell, where they have more of an institutional culture, where you can change the person at the top, and yes, it'll look different, but because they came from that culture, their replacement will likely have kind of the same DNA. Not the same at all with these little companies. You get a new person in charge and it can be 180 degrees in terms of the organizational strategy and the capital allocation. And so it really, really matters. The character, the ethics, and the motivations of the people in charge.
Are you an investor that likes to talk to management and listen to them, or do you prefer to read the filings and just go off that?
I'm a filings first person. I want to get a full picture of what I think the company is and what it's worth from their public filings before I reach out to management. And I do like to talk to them, but I'm very cognizant that of the bias that they're always going to have. I've never once had a CEO tell me that their company's in trouble and their competitors and they've been at their heels and they're really worried about something. No, everything's always wonderful. The sun's always shining. Their best time is just around the corner always. And so, I mean, I know that I'm a human being and I'm biased as well on certain things. And why should I expect any better of most people? And I don't think that management out and out lies to me, but I do know that there are things they'd rather talk about that people steer the conversation toward. And so I don't want to be in a position where I talk to a company first and I come away excited and feeling super optimistic about things, because that leads me to ignore things, red flags that I might see in the financial filings. My philosophy always is, if the company is good, if the people in charge are smart and do good things, it'll always show up in the filings eventually through operationally success, through cash flow, through growth, through good return on capital. And so that's more important to me. But now and then I have a question about strategy or I'm confused about something and I want to hear straight from management. And sometimes you just want to make sure they're a serious person. You can't really underestimate that. There's a lot of dilettantes in these little companies where they're the CEO because daddy was before them, and they may or not be capable and effective. And it's good to get a picture, idea of that as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. I along those lines. I think not saying, okay, well, this guy is related to this guy, and therefore he must have absorbed some of this DNA, right? Or they came from the same company, so they think the same. I think those kind of heuristics can be dangerous.
Very much. And I mean, for me, what I see a lot is there's a little company, and especially in these little manufacturers and community banks and in small rural places, that it was their father or their grandfather who founded the company, and the second generation built it. And the third generation is so terrified of messing up that they're afraid to, they're just kind of paralyzed. They're afraid to take any kind of risk, you know, no matter how attractive the reward might be, because they're just so terrified of ruining the legacy. And I guess that's better than the total opposite of just being totally profligate and doing whatever and just taking whatever risk you can find just to try to build an empire. But there's got to be a happy medium where I just want to nudge a few of them and say, yeah, I know, like, you're proud of your company. You've been a community pillar for 100 years. But look, you got to do better than a 5% ROE at the end of the day.
Yeah. Do you? So I noticed in one of your letters that you have a position in, what are they, the community development banks? I'm not saying it the right way. What is it?
Yeah, so this is
what's
an interesting situation.
Yeah, what's the technical term for these that I can't think of?
CDFI, Community Development Financial Institution.
There you go.
This is a legal signifier that basically means that these banks are lending in areas that are historically economically disadvantaged across the country, wherever they are. But they just they help with housing, household formation, and economic development in these troubled areas.
Do you think that? Well, I'm going to ask it this way. Do you think that part of why you were open to that idea is that you understand how smaller community banks work? Or does that have nothing to do with it?
No, I
just because when you're talking this way, I kind of, that idea rang out to me, and I was like, oh, I wonder if that's kind of why Dave found himself looking at these.
Yeah, and I think I have a little bit of a different perspective than a lot of investors in that I grew up in an insanely rural area where our town got a stoplight in high school, and it was the biggest controversy that ever happened. There were letters to the editor in the local paper. Yeah, there was no movie theater, no fast food. It was, you know, an hour drive to see a movie or something. And that's very different than a lot of other investment managers who, you know, grew up in the suburbs of wherever. And I mean, not me. I grew up on a mountain in central Pennsylvania. So, yeah.
Interesting.
I've seen
what was the economy? What was the economy there?
Well, bad, first of all. But
yeah,
timber, oil and gas, the local hospital. There was a UPS center there, and my dad was in charge of that. And that's how we ended up there in the first place.
Interesting.
But, yeah. Mm-hmm. But natural resources, basically.
In fact, yeah, makes sense there.
Yeah. I spent a summer working at a sawmill, and it was insanely difficult, but it led me to have eternal respect for that kind of work at the end of the day.
Yeah. Huh. So what got you interested in finance?
Oh, yeah. Good question. So, like I said, my dad was a lifelong UPSer. Started out as a lifelong, he's still with us. He is retired, is what I mean. Yeah. Started out as a package loader and a driver when I was very young. Eventually got promoted to management and ended up managing sort of the northwestern Pennsylvania region. UPS for a very, very long time was employee-owned. And he, from the very beginning, did something very wise and participated fully in the employee stock ownership program. And from the time he started in the 70s, was buying shares with every paycheck. Well, UPS finally went public in, I think, 1999, kind of in the middle of
the
bubble.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. That kind of business was maybe trading a little cheap, but still smart.
It didn't get the 400% pop that, you know, dot-com names were at the time, but it was still, you know, 35% of something on the first day. So pretty good.
Yeah.
But it suddenly left my dad with a very comfortable retirement. A guy who is pretty blue collar and eventually moved into management, but certainly had never expected to have a stock portfolio or anything in his life, was suddenly doing just fine. And I was amazed by that. Because no one else I knew had any kind of investments or ever talked about the stock market or their brokerage account or whatever. I mean, most people were blue collar. I mean, you worked an hourly job and if you had a little pension or something, you were lucky. Otherwise, Social Security was your hope. But I was like, wow, you can take some of your money and you can buy something and you can do nothing. But if you wait 5, 10, 20 years, it could be worth 10, 20, 50 times what you paid for it. That was mind-blowing to me. But to that point in my life, I've never heard of any way to make money except the sweat of your brow. You know, I give you an hour of my time, you give me $8 or whatever. I didn't know that, like I said, your money can make money. That was mind-blowing to me, and I was, you know, 13 or 14. So after that, I started reading I'd get the Sunday paper, and I'd look at the stock quotes for the Dow Jones components, and it was still fractions back then, but before decimals. But I thought, this is amazing. And I knew nothing about it, of course. But the very first moment I could, I took $1,000 that I'd earned from a summer job or something and opened up a ScottTrade account and promptly blew all of my money on stupid trades because I had no idea what I was doing.
Good for you. That's a rite of passage.
I think everyone should do it with a tiny amount of money. It's way better than doing it with $100,000 or something very meaningful. Yeah, so believe me, I regretted my $1,000, but I knew I could make it again eventually. But that's kind of how it started.
That's cool. When did you go to college and knew that you wanted to go into finance? So specialized at that point, or was it kind of more of a hobby still?
No, I mean, I knew I wanted to study business and finance. I went to a tiny little school in Western Pennsylvania no one's ever heard of called Grove City College. Didn't really know much about colleges. I mean, like I said, no one I knew had really gone to college or at least graduated traditionally. And so I just kind of went to the local school. Good school, but not well known. Not exactly a path to Wall Street is what I'm saying. But I took finance, enjoyed it, and got a job at a little trust bank in Philadelphia called Wilmington Trust. And the timing was very interesting. Yeah, they're the old DuPont family private bank. They still, I think, manage some money for those heirs. But it was an interesting time. I mean, this was June of 2007 is when I got my first job at that institution. And Wilmington Trust was a very respectable little trust bank, had a very good trust in the State Department and all that jazz. But they decided they wanted to be a big dog. And so on their bank side, they made every condo loan up and down the East Coast to developers everywhere. And they ended up blowing up a year later. So I kind of saw the writing on the wall. I mean, it's not every day you join a company and the shares are at $40 and a year later they're at $8. Typically not a good sign for the health of the company.
Yeah, no.
And I didn't really enjoy it. It just wasn't for me. So I ended up bouncing back to Pittsburgh, which is the area closer to where I live, where friends and family are. And I went to work for Bank of New York Mellon after that.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's neat, man. Well, that's a cool story.
Well, I really got kind of lucky. I mean, I graduated college in 07. I got a job at a bank. If I'd been a year later, like friends of mine were, nobody was hiring in finance for like another 2 years because we're in the teeth of the crisis. And I even got lucky, you know, bouncing over to Mellon because Mellon was one of the banks, Bank New York Mellon, that came through the strongest in the crisis and never really felt like my job was at risk. But, you know, every day you'd wake up and there'd be news of, you know, State Street lays off, you know, 5,000, JP Morgan, Wachovia, you know, blows up, gets acquired. And it all feels like old war stories now. I mean, I'm not a young man anymore, really. But yeah, it felt very vivid at the time. But my role at those banks was just sort of a wealth management associate. You know, basically my job was to make our high net worth and affluent clients feel special. And that's one reason I ended up moving on is because I realized it wasn't really an investment job. I saw that my role at these banks was going to be eventually to become a portfolio manager. And what that meant was that 3-4 nights a week, I'd be taking clients to sporting events and the symphony and stuff like that and acting like we were best friends and just making them feel special and taken care of. And not to say that's not a good thing. I mean, a lot of these people did need advice and just hand-holding on creating that asset allocation. But end of the day, every trust bank's investment product is relatively the same. And you have an S&P 500 plug-in where, you know, if they're off by 50 basis points in a year, that's too much tracking error for that. And it's too much risk. And it's a stay rich kind of role, not a make people rich kind of role. And so I quickly realized that if I wanted to do actual investment research and try to find my own ideas and try to make money off them, I had to move on. And coming from my sort of non-traditional background, you know, small town, little known college, no real blue chips on my resume, I started writing research and posting it online with the idea that somebody would see it. And if they liked it, I'd get a job at a hedge fund or something.
And where would you post? Seeking Alpha or something?
Yeah. So I used to have, it's actually, I think it's still up. I should check on that actually. I would write at otcadventures.com. The reason being that the large majority of my early research was on stocks that traded over the counter. It was a really fortuitous time for me to do that. It was just 2012, because we were still just a couple years past the crisis. Investors were still just terrified to put capital to work in equities, especially anything small, off the run, less liquid. And so the OTC markets were just spilling over with incredibly cheap companies. I mean, good little manufacturers trading at 4 or 5 times earnings, high quality banks, even little tech companies on there, profitable, growing, you know, 20-30% a year and 10x earnings or something. I mean, it was great. So I had a lot of fun finding those ideas. And believe me, I look back now at some of my early research and like, oh man, what was I thinking with that one? But it was a part of my development and it was a part of my process. And the feedback that I got, and I got a lot of feedback because at the time there was not a lot of public investment blogs. It was great and helpful. And I developed a lot of relationships that way. And eventually I decided to kind of go out on my own and start my own investment management company. And a lot of my readers from OTC Adventures became my earliest clients, which is
really,
really, really, really cool. Yeah.
A lot of them were neat.
Yeah. A lot of them were investors, you know, a generation older than me or so, who, I don't know, maybe saw a little bit of themselves in me as a younger man or something. Or a lot of them too were investors who were close to retirement and wanted to diversify their strategy a little bit or spend more time with the grandkids and kind of outsource a little bit of their portfolio to someone else. And so, yeah, I launched an RIA with about $3 million under management in early 2014.
Wow.
Just felt like I had to do it. I had a good job at the bank. The money was okay. The job wasn't that difficult, but I had plenty of time to do my own thing on the nights and weekends, but it just was unfulfilling. And I told my girlfriend at the time, now wife, and she was really supportive. And she was like, yeah, you got to go for it. At the time I was, you know, 28 or something, few responsibilities, few financial responsibilities, you know, no mortgage, no kids, no nothing, just sitting there in my cheap little apartment in Pittsburgh. I thought, like, now's the time to go for it. I'm going to launch an RIA. If I get traction, awesome. I'll have a business. If after 2 years, I still can't take a paycheck, well, I'll dust off the resume and crawl back to a bank somewhere and at least I'll know. But fortunately, it went well.
Yeah, that's cool, man. So what, it's been 9 or 10 years, right? What did you say, 2013, 2014? 2014,
yeah, 2014.
You said.
2014. Yeah. I mean, life changes. Like now, you know, I have a couple kids. I live in the suburbs. I have a house, you know, responsibilities that I, life looks a lot different now, but I'm still having a ton of fun finding, you know, the same kind of ideas for more clients now, but still small.
Do you get nervous in the smaller stuff or does... It sounds so stupid coming out of my, whatever. Or does like the market really work in the smaller things, you know, because sometimes when I look at how micro caps have traded in aggregate, or you see what small caps have done, you know, I guess there's a question out there whether or not they're sort of destined to underperform as a class, or whether or not, you know, you just, has the S&P run too far too fast? I don't really know. But it's just kind of an interesting thought. And the other rebuttable, I guess, question that comes up a lot is, you know, hasn't private equity picked over a lot of these? Why are these things even public? Like, what do you think about some of those, my rambling that just occurred?
Well, I honestly think the same sorts of things about a lot of these companies. The first question I have to ask, especially in American small caps, micro caps, is why is this company public? If they're so good, like, why haven't they been acquired by private equity, or why hasn't management taken them private, or a larger competitor buy them out, or something? Because it's a rough go in this era being a small American public company. I mean, your compliance and reporting costs are, you know, upwards of $1 million a year, and you have to lay out all your info there for your competitors to look at and undercut you on bids and stuff. And you're just not getting any attention from investors. I mean, the flow of capital from active to passive strategies, especially in small cap, and it has been relentless over the past decade. And a lot of it's well-deserved. I mean, you look back 15, 20 years ago, there were just too many active managers and too many of them not delivering for their clients and not adding any value. And so it's not surprising they ended up losing their mandate and the capital flowed away. But I don't know, maybe the pendulum swung too far, because I see so many opportunities where the cost of capital has just increased so much that I honestly think that very few small public companies should stay public. Most of them should go private. But now and again, of course, there are opportunities where you do have a good quality company that can finance its growth internally, and so it doesn't have to worry too much about the cost of equity capital. But yeah, I will say that if you compare the average small cap, micro cap that is out there today versus what was out there even just 10 years ago, it is more weighted toward growth. It is more, well, loss-making, frankly. I think if you look at the percentage of Russell 2000 components that don't make money, it's like 40% or something. It's high. Just because a large number of high-quality, very profitable small companies have gone private. So it's a bit of a tougher game than it was 10 years ago, but internationally, it's not quite the same. There's still a really robust small-cap, micro-cap environment in Western Europe and Australia and places like that. So there's still plenty to do. But yeah, I mean, I'm not super optimistic about microcaps and small caps as a class over the next several years, just because I think the quality has been downgraded and I just don't see a lot of momentum for people to get reinterested in the sector and spend more time looking there. And I don't see cash flow coming in. And a lot of the performance is just about flows, of course.
Yeah. The loss making, at least from what you've seen, does it have the prospect of profits down the road, or is it just kind of loss-making in public? So a lot of it's biotech, right? I mean, not, I shouldn't, yeah. I don't know how much the total
percentage is. Yeah. There's a lot of that. A lot of biotech, but there's a lot of, you know, de-SPAC stuff that's kind of followed on harder times and is going to be down there for a while. There's a lot of companies where, frankly, their business is equity issuance. They're just sort of compensation scheme. At the end of the day, they're not an actual business. And so, yeah, I mean, it's fairly easy to avoid those. It's not so hard to look at a company and realize, you know, is this a real company? Does it have an actual product, or is it just all vapor? It's not hard to avoid those, but I mean, they're out there and somebody's buying them.
Not so easy in the public market, like the bigger caps, you know, just like the tech space. I think that would be what the bears might say about that, is that they're pretty decent compensation schemes. You know, I mean,
yeah, I think so.
It's kind of, I think the truth is kind of in between, but when all your free cash flow is stock-based comp and you buy that stock-based comp back and your share count doesn't go down, and I don't know, the debate that's well had, and I don't know that there's any great answers, but they don't make me very comfortable, I guess.
I'm in the same boat.
Yeah, well, the good news is you don't need to shoot all the shots, right? You just need to find a few shots that you're comfortable with.
That's absolutely the case. I mean, I sometimes, you know, psych myself out a little bit thinking, oh, you know, it's been months since I found a great idea. Like, what am I doing here? Like, have I lost touch? Am I just, did the market change? I didn't change with it. And no, it's usually about that time that I start despairing that I find the next idea. But you only need one or two really good ideas a year to outperform. That's all it takes. And I encourage people not to get down on themselves and not to start panicking and buying, like, middling quality ideas just because they're running low on high quality stuff. Just wait around.
Do you get nervous at all when you're going to like a Western European exchange? Do you get nervous at all about rule of law or cultural differences or anything like that? Like, I know you're not afraid to go around the world, and I'm just kind of curious how you think about whether or not the risks are any different. Or if they're not.
Yeah, I'd say in Western Europe European exchanges, I'm not really worried at all about legal protections. The court system is very well defined and predictable. There can be some wrinkles, and you need to just understand things like takeover law, and there's various triggers for mandatory tenders and things like that. And so you have to do some research around that. But end of the day, I have very few concerns about disclosure quality and the rule of law, things like that. Culturally, that's all. I mean, that's important. I tend to stick to businesses that satisfy some fundamental need that's more or less constant across human populations around the world. Like, I'm invested in a Latvian cosmetics manufacturer because people want to be attractive. Always will, always have. You look at things like people want to eat good food. People want to have fun. People want to have a roof over their head. I stick to businesses like that. I don't do international financials because, you know, total black box, and, you know, regulators can act by fiat and kind of mess up your investment thesis. I tend to avoid those kind of businesses. But yeah, simple businesses selling things that people have always wanted and needed and always will want and need, I'm happy to do that overseas because I know that the consumer in Finland or South Africa or Indonesia, they're just like me in that way.
Yeah. I've been dabbling in the very cyclical, like, RV boat stuff, just because I think what makes me want to throw up inside looking at our macro environment, and those are the ideas. And I was surprised to see, and I should have known it, but, you know, whatever, it gets lost. That Berkshire owns Forest River, and I knew that Clayton, but I didn't realize that Buffett had been in RVs for so long. And it's, I've been thinking to myself, like, why does that fit? I wonder. I need to go back and look more at that acquisition, but it's kind of lower on the hierarchy of needs. But I do think it offers a reasonably cheap or affordable experience that involves travel, which I think travel has become much more a part of our culture. But I've been thinking about where on Maslow's hierarchy do you want to play, and sort of like theoretically, where should things trade based on the hierarchy? I don't know. It's just been something I've been messing around in my head with. I don't know that there's any good answers, by the way. It's just like, I talked to Alex, my boy, the science of hitting, and we just like bullshit about this. I think it's a fun thing to talk about.
It is, and I think we can generally conclude that the more of an aspiration something is over a need, the more cyclical and economically sensitive it tends to be. And an RV is not, you know, a luxury product. You can buy luxury RVs, but a lot of people, especially my parents, most of my family actually owns RVs, and they love it. In this, it's a growing industry, and so yeah, is it economically sensitive? It is, but maybe not as much as they know that Cartier bracelet or something, but an industry I'm actually looking a lot at is swimming pools in Europe. This is interesting because there's multiple high quality swimming pool products and maintenance companies in Europe, and they all massively over-earned during COVID. I mean, that's not really up for debate. They tripled sometimes their earnings from the previous year, but now, because we're mostly behind that and things are normalized, some of these shares are down 70-80% for fundamentally high quality businesses. And yeah, I mean, the year over year comps look terrible because, you know, we're still coming off that COVID high. But just sort of normalizing these businesses, especially over the new base of installed units in France or Sweden or whatever, some of these are trading, you know, mid-single digit multiples of earnings if you normalize over the cycle, and it's really interesting. But I love looking at those because I know that in the U.S., a business like this that might have the same economics or something is probably trading at between 15 and 20 times earnings. But I can buy a business of equal or better quality oftentimes in Europe at half the multiple because there's just no one looking. If you talk about small caps and micro caps sort of being a desert island in the U.S. in terms of people actually doing fundamental research, it goes double for anywhere outside the U.S. There's just almost no one looking.
I mean, Pool Corp, if you could get that at 15 times, that's super cheap relative to where it's been trading. It got kind of nutty there for a minute. In your experience, how much do you see stocks trading on like acceleration and decelerating fundamentals versus like, the way I want to say it is like a free cash flow yield and what a private business owner would pay? Because it seems to me that a lot of the times they trade on rate of change and improving or decelerating or even declining fundamental reasons. And I'm unclear. I mean, those two comments are obviously correlated at some point, right? If things are getting worse, the cash flow is going to be worse. But I'm not, I do think that the acceleration and deceleration probably causes the overshoots. I'm just curious what you've seen.
Oh, totally. I mean, I see that all the time. And I think that another sort of related concept is that investors tend to put companies into buckets. You have your hyper growth companies and then your compounders and then sort of your GDP growers and then your kind of stagnant companies and then you're mounting ice cubes. And it can be a really painful transition or a really great transition when the market upgrades or downgrades a company between one of those segments. And I find I think what we're seeing is a lot of companies got valued as if they were, you know, hyper growth or at least a high quality compounder, just based on their COVID results. But people are learning that, oh, you know, that was a one-off or that's not sustainable and maybe this business is just kind of okay. And so you're getting share turnover between people who only want to invest in the highest growth opportunities. They just want to see constant huge revenue growth and don't care so much about current cash flow. And so the share gets punished and it takes a while for a new set of shareholders to come in and take over. And so actually some of the best opportunities are when you can identify a company that the market has misclassified, especially is penalizing it. Because a few years ago, for instance, I was really highly invested in rural telecoms, which is about the worst business you can imagine. I mean, there's no growth, it's capital intensive, nobody wants to own it. But what the market didn't realize was they were about to get hit with a wave of government subsidy to help them build out their fiber optic networks. And so you had these businesses valued at, you know, 3-4 times cash flows as melting ice cubes when they were actually okay businesses that were going to grow their top line at, you know, mid-single digits for the next decade and convert a lot of that into free cash flow. And there was a lot of money to be made once the stock kind of re-rated. So I think a lot about re-ratings. If I can find something that I think is actually a pretty decent business, but the market is valuing it at just an okay business. If I'm right, eventually the shares will come around. But it's painful, though, if you misclassify in the other direction.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the ideas of trying to ride subsidies. I would like to say that I learned it from Buffett. I don't know that I can. I'm probably not smart enough to learn anything from him, but I do think if you watch what he does, subsidies are a non-insignificant portion.
Oh yeah, and that's sort of the genesis of my bank investment now with the ECIP, where the Treasury injected all this incredibly low cost preferred stock into many, many different institutions across the country, and yeah, I mean these banks sometimes double their equity. And it costs them no more than 2% a year forever for these prefs. And I talk about this, and now and then I get an investor pushing back, like, oh, this is such a waste of taxpayer money. Like, I can't believe this is happening. And to me, I'm like, okay, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But you can be mad about it, or you can figure out how to make money from it. And yeah. I see that in a lot of cases.
Well, I've been messing around trying to figure out industrial companies that are going to benefit from the Inflation Reduction Act.
Yes, and huge story.
I think I found a few. Anybody that's listening that wants to send me more, I am all for. Because I think we haven't even really hit like any meaningful payments out, right, to these companies.
Right.
And I think people are, I'm sure some of the models on the street are starting to incorporate it, but I have a sense, an inkling that they're probably going to be more subsidies than people realize. And when they come in, there might be some divisions of some of these sort of forgotten about or boring businesses that may generate a decent amount of, I don't know, narrative excitement, for lack of a better term.
And that kind of comes back to some of these businesses that we reclassified from stodgy, boring, low growth businesses, you know, worth 12, 15 times earnings to businesses that should be worth 20 or 25. Yeah, I mean, this this industrial policy that we have, this investment, it'll be huge.
You've got the left for dead businesses, and I think they could catch like a little bit of a growthy narrative. And you know, if you're okay owning what currently exists, and you can catch a narrative, that could be a nice combo.
Yeah, that can be a big thing. You have to think about what would it take for investors to value this company that you're investing in at a higher multiple or a bigger premium to asset value, and having some kind of macro narrative at your back is helpful, especially in the smaller companies, which I think don't often get revalued to their appropriate value as a result of the macroeconomic environment changing.
Yeah. Have you ever done an SPV?
I haven't. I've wanted to a couple of times. I've had a couple of ideas which I thought would be interesting, but yeah, it's probably in the future for me though.
Yeah. I'm asking because I have been talking to Kyle Mowry about Covest a little bit, and I don't know. It's an interesting thing. I think it'd be, you seem like the kind of guy that will probably have one at some point. I have a sense that, you know, and something that you said earlier that triggered my mind was you said, some of the management teams are not great at telling their story. And that's a place where I can actually see investment managers adding real value to teams, right?
Sure.
Like, in a real way. So it's nice. Could be a good marriage.
Yeah. I think if I ever did some sort of special vehicle, it would probably be on a theme. I mean, sometimes for instance, a couple of years ago, like Italian IPOs were incredibly cheap. There were businesses going public at, you know, 5x cash flow for no good reason other than there was a flurry of them and not enough capital to take down all the equity that was being issued. And so they were going off super cheap. And that's kind of in the rearview mirror now. But I mean, now again, I come across a theme like that.
Was that going on when there was the Italian debt crisis and all that?
Well, it was kind of the aftermath. This was like 2018, 2019. And I
that's not that long ago.
I mean, investors are always fighting the last battle, right? I mean, after the great financial crisis, people were afraid that we'd go into a new recession and banks would blow up again. And so they were very hesitant. People were really hesitant to invest in Europe for a number of years because you had, you know, what was the acronym, PIGS or something, all the debt burdened economies over there, and that kept people out. And they were amazing businesses trading at single digit cash flow multiples and growing. But eventually people got over their fear and those all revalued sort of almost overnight. I mean, I'm looking at Japan right now, and I've never really done much in Japan, but it really seems like there's a push from the government to force some of these small, under-earning, like overcapitalized businesses to normalize their balance sheets and actually produce some return for shareholders. And that could be another theme. I don't know. But yeah, there's always something going on somewhere. You just look around enough.
Yeah, Japan's interesting because culturally, until fairly recently, you haven't heard that discussion over there, right? Like my understanding of the culture over there is fairly conservative on a balance sheet perspective, and you've got like this trapped cash, and you know, it'd be interesting. I guess that activists started to go over, I think that was pre-COVID, and then COVID happened.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Then again, you can get activists over Zoom, I suspect, but I bet that I bet that culture probably rewards in face or face to face meetings more than, hey, I'm on a Zoom and I have an activist idea for you to get aggressive with your balance sheet.
I think you're typical fast talking, very, very polished American investment manager would have to overcome a lot of cultural hurdles, especially over remote. Yeah, I wouldn't put the odds too high. But the government saying, okay, 30 years of a sideways stock market is enough might have more of an impact. And it seems like that's what's starting to happen.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. It's exciting. I've really enjoyed, first of all, thank you for coming on. But I've really enjoyed a lot of these smaller conversations that I've had, Ian Castle and I mean, Randy Barron got me thinking about looking outside the U.S. more in this smaller area. I am terrified of like finding myself a hot stove, but I may I may circle back with some of you guys that are smarter than me and say, where am I dumb here? And and maybe add value to y'all's network. That'd be fun. Other than just like being, you know, on the pod.
Yeah, well, always an open book. The exchange of ideas is what this is all about. And yeah, I enjoyed your conversation with Ian Castle and other people too. And yeah, I appreciate what you do.
Yeah, man. Well, I you know, people can find you. You've been on Andrew Walker's a number of times. I like the P10 conversation. Why do asset managers sell to P10? What's the win-win-win of that whole relationship? Because it seems to have some pretty good legs.
Yeah, few things. I mean, it comes to a point where there can be a generational transition at a firm where the founders want to monetize a part of their investment while retaining economic exposure. So they can sell their management fee stream to P10 and retain the carry. So they still get upside, but they get a nice chunk of change to go do whatever with and, you know, enjoy life a little bit. They also get a currency, which they can reward their younger employees, which is great because a lot of times it's just, you know, it's more difficult to reward them other than, you know, phantom equity units or whatever. And now they have an actual publicly tradable stock, which is great. And as well as some career diversification. I mean, maybe you worked your whole life to build up a strategy. Maybe you're 50 and you're a venture or something, and you're very cognizant that if the next venture cycle goes terribly, then you could lose a lot of what you worked for. And, you know, why not diversify and get exposure to these other strategies as well? And that's the constant thing with smaller alternative investment managers is you're only as good as your last fund. At any point, if you have a fund that goes poorly and not even your fault, just macro issues or whatever, you might have a lot of difficulty raising the next fund. And so, yeah, it can make sense at some point to take some chips off the table and become a part of a larger group. Same reason as any investment manager might sell to a larger group is risk reduction, diversification, and a partial, ring the register a little bit. Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I guess if you're looking at it and you're saying, okay, well, I know how they diligenced me and I think I'm reasonably good at what I do and now I can get shares of a company that might have a group of managers that are of similar quality, and I like the idea of alternative asset managers or hedge funds or whatever over time, then to your point, you can take a little bit off the table but still have some beta to that sector.
Right, and I like that they're only buying the management fee stream and leaving the carry with the managers, because I mean, it's such a people business. The biggest risk is you buy, we see this all the time with investment manager buyouts is, you get bought and then the senior people who actually add the value just waltz away and there goes all the value. But in this case, they're incentivized to stick around and keep on making money because they retain the carry. It's only in the management fee that's now with P10, and in which they, of course, still have exposure to because they take stock as well when they get bought out.
Yeah. One thing that annoys me, but I also kind of understand it, but the public market doesn't really care about carry anyway. It seems.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
It's kind of nuts to me because it's so important to most people's comp scheme, but the public market's not going to capitalize it anyway. So to your point, if you can leave some on the plate for people to be incentivized to stay, then you protect your earnings stream, which is what the public market actually capitalizes.
I think that they very much thought of that, is that they can create a very bond-like cash flow stream, and that's something the market will capitalize. Because like you said, I mean, even the majors, even your KKR and Blackstone, they don't get a multiple on their carry because it's unstable and the market hates things that are unstable.
Yeah.
So even though it's huge and extremely economically material to the value of the company, they get like what, a 3x or something typically on the annual carry earnings just because it's unpredictable.
Yeah.
And the market has an incredible love for anything that's predictable, and it really despises anything that is unpredictable.
Yeah, I guess if I wanted to argue the bear side of it, I'd maybe say, well, it's easy to say in a declining interest rate environment. So carry, you know, if we get into a raising environment, multiples come down, carry will come down. I don't know. That mm-hmm. I guess would mm-hmm. be my best argument against it. But I tend to think it should, I don't know, my brain would capitalize it higher. Maybe I'd just be overpaying. What do I know? Anyway, those are the thoughts of me on that topic. Yeah, man. I don't know. I don't have anything else. I went through. Oh, what's your end goal? Where does Alluvial end up? Where, you know, 10 years we do this podcast again. What's Dave Waters doing?
Yeah, man. I'll be super happy if I can be managing more capital. Not a ton. Right now we run around 150 million. If I can get to about 100 or 150, that's all I want. At that point, I can invest in the stuff I think is fun to invest in. but I also will have enough that I can do some wild stuff. You know, I can do an SPV, I can do a couple of privates here and there maybe, and I can have a lot of fun with it while making a lot of money for my partners is the goal. I don't care about being on CNBC. I don't care. I don't want to be in the business press. That doesn't matter to me. I'm not going to become some sharp-elbowed activist, you know, writing mean letters to management all the time. I just want to find cool stuff and work on that all day and work with enough capital to really get access to some of the cool opportunities I see out there and do stuff on crazy exchanges around the world and just have a good time with it. I mean, the best part of this business is that I don't have a boss other than my LPs, which I very much consider my boss. But it's me setting my schedule. It's me putting my time to the best use that I think I can find. And I think I do a good job. But at the end of the day, I don't have to go crawling up to some boss to try to make them feel happy and determine the course of my career. This is the best thing I could imagine. I never thought I'd be so lucky as to be able to spend my day going down rabbit holes and reading weird filings from some company in Portugal or something. It's a ton of fun. I love it. So more of the same. I mean, I'm 37. I hope to be doing this when I'm 77 or older. And so I got to keep delivering for clients. And that means waking up every day and trying to find the next ridiculous idea that somehow makes a lot of sense and makes money.
Yeah. Well, I think it is super cool that you're a kid from a town that very few people have your path and you've done it and you created your own firm and it's going well. And I wish you much continued success because I think it's fucking awesome, man. You are the American dream. So keep it going.
Well, I appreciate it. I owe a lot of other people a lot of gratitude for helping me get here. Definitely didn't do it alone.
Yeah. Well, none of us do. So I will continue to root for you. And should you ever want to come on again, hit me up. You got an open invite.
Appreciate it. A lot of fun. Keep up the good work.